Hello, this is Kathy Hart, host of the Health First Radio Show. Today we have some really interesting guests lined up. We have Brant Myers, and he's the author of Painkiller in the first half. And in the second half, we have Dr. Brian Carpenter talking about how precious silver really is to us. But first, here's Alan with the Health First News.
Many patients with mild to moderate COVID-19 could become long haulers, suffering symptoms months after they clear their non-life-threatening infection, new research shows. About 33% of COVID-19 patients who were never sick enough to require hospitalization continue to complain months later of symptoms like fatigue, loss of smell or taste, and brain fog, University of Washington researchers found. Lead researcher Jennifer Logue said they were surprised to have one-third of people with mild illness still experiencing symptoms. She's a research scientist with the university's Department of Medicine's Division of Allergy and Infectious Diseases in Seattle. She added, if you contract coronavirus, there's a good chance you could experience a lingering effect. The findings were published online February 19th in JAMA Network Open. Children have largely been spared severe COVID-19 infection, and new research hints at why. In the study, children's immune systems attacked the new coronavirus faster and more aggressively than adult systems did, the findings showed. The researchers analyzed blood samples from 48 children and 70 adults who lived in 28 households in Melbourne, Australia, and who were infected with or exposed to the coronavirus. The participants' immune responses were assessed during the acute phase of infection and for up to 2 months after that. Children had a stronger immune response to the virus than adults, according to the report published online February 17th in the journal Nature Communications. The typical yoga class might look like a room full of people bending and twisting themselves into various positions, but yoga is more than a series of pretzel-like poses. It's a whole-body practice that uses movement, deep breathing, and relaxation. You don't have to be athletic or even very mobile to benefit. If you can breathe, you can practice yoga, says Carol Krukoff, a certified yoga therapist at Duke Integrative Medicine. But a variation, called the adaptive yoga, is designed to open up the practice to everyone, including people with movement-limiting conditions like multiple sclerosis, arthritis, or spinal cord injuries. You finally managed to score an appointment to be vaccinated against the new coronavirus, and you're a little nervous about side effects, so taking a painkiller right before you get your shot seems like a smart idea. Not so fast, says the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Instead, the agency is telling people not to take pain medications like Motrin, Advil, or Tylenol before getting their COVID-19 vaccines. Why? It's possible that taking a painkiller before getting a vaccine will result in a decrease in antibody response, explained Dr. Gregory Poland, director of the Vaccine Research Group at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Although the odds of a diminished immune response aren't really known, Poland says it's better to suffer the side effects than take the chance of making the vaccine less effective.
Brant Myers is with us today, and he is the author of the book Painkiller, which just came out. It was released February 16th by Penguin House, and they're the memoirs of his big league addiction. He's the only player to be banned for life from the NHL. So, welcome, Brant.
That's quite the introduction.
that's quite the life that you've documented in this book. There's just so much to so much that you've shared of the pain and the challenges and the ability, just like a game, to get up and play again and play again. In this whole thing of the NHL, did you ever just think of just giving up and not getting up one more time?
Oh, geez. You know, I don't know what it was as far as the fighting spirit goes, but it seemed like I was caught in a bit of a vicious cycle just in regards to, you know, wanting to still pursue my dream of playing in the best league in the world, but also struggling with the fact that I was, you know, having to perform a role that really took a toll on me mentally, and then at the end physically. So it was just, again, sort of a constant struggle that I was dealing with.
Mm-hmm. There's quite a few of the sports people in the hockey league that wind up in this kind of habitual rehab style?
Yeah, you know, that's kept under wraps. I think for the most part, But the general consensus from the guys that I played with or against that performed that, I guess you could call it a enforcer or tough guy role, I would say 75% of them, maybe even a bit more, struggled with dependency.
Mm-hmm. And did you ever think that you could go from having millions to being broke?
Well, they told me that. They're like, you know what, if you're not careful with your finances and post-education and et cetera, it could all be gone very quickly. And when you're young and you're making that type of money, it literally feels like it's never going to end. And then you add on a cocaine and alcohol addiction, and then spending a couple years in rehab and not getting paid throughout that whole thing. So you find yourself, or I found myself, at the age of, I believe, 33, flat broke. And it was a real scary moment.
Wow. Yeah. And what changed at that moment?
Well, there's probably a couple things. One is my last night of drinking, which was February 17th, 2008, where I got arrested by two cops. And I don't remember anything about the night. I lost time from about, I think, 7:30 at night until around 2:30 in the morning. And what I did in the blackout was pretty scary. I write about it in the book. And that next morning, I just got on my knees and I said a really long, hard prayer, and I just said, I'm done, just need some help. If somebody could help me this one last time. And they did. The league raised their hand out and offered to pay for treatment again for my fifth rehab, and it worked.
Hmm. And you were in rehab for, was it a year at a time sometimes?
No.
Or that was accumulation.
Yeah, so the first rehab was 3 months. The second rehab was 3 months. The third was 6 months. The fourth was a year. And then the fifth was 8 months.
Wow. Yeah. So you really, really learned what it takes. Now, I found it interesting that you actually went to school in Calgary at the university for addiction and really learned about addiction. What piece did you learn there that never came up before?
Well, I never really sort of dove in, or I guess accepted the science behind it. I always struggled back and forth with the thought of thinking it was a willpower issue when it came to addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't. It was something that, it was a disease that I was struggling from. So when I started opening up those books and I actually really loved being in class. Never in my life did I enjoy school until that moment.
Wow.
And yeah, and I just found it just really interesting learning about this stuff. And excited to wake up in the morning and open up the books and I guess have a course on Brant Myers.
And now something really, really important came into your life as sort of a catalyst to recovery. How does your daughter play into all this?
Yeah, so Chloe was, so when I went to treatment around the 21st mm-hmm. of February, she was born a week later. So I didn't get to see my daughter until I believe she was 8 months old. Mm-hmm. And that was really tough. But that being said, she's never seen me loaded. And mm-hmm. I take a sobriety birthday before she takes her belly button birthday. And I want to keep it that way.
Wow, that's amazing. So she doesn't know the other half until she reads the book.
That's right. And she's a little bit too young. I don't know if I necessarily want her reading the whole thing at this moment. I don't mind her reading the first couple chapters, but then it gets a little graphic.
Yeah, yeah. When you went to rehab for the fifth time, did you think, oh, here I go again? Or did you think, yeah, this is going to be different?
Oh, completely different. I was in a completely different headspace. Something, again, it's this sort of feeling or warm sensation that morning when I woke up, saying that you're finally finished. And I didn't struggle with that anymore. It was an awesome feeling, to tell you the truth, because for so many years I had that gorilla, you know, 1,000-pound gorilla on my back, mm-hmm. talking to me all the time. Mm-hmm. And then it wasn't there anymore, so I was able to go there and just sort of be honest and open about everything, and really enjoyed my time in Astoria.
So all the pain and all the challenges. Do you remember a time when all the fun turned to pain?
Yeah, I would say probably when I went into my first treatment center, mm-hmm. when the Philadelphia Flyers released me from the team because of my drinking and drug use. I was 24 years old, and I just remember going into rehab going, okay, I don't think I'll ever be able to look at drinking and partying or feel that same way like I used to when I was young, mm-hmm. because now there's, you know, there's just a lot of stress attached to cracking that first beer, and a lot was riding on it. So even though I was laughing and high-fiving guys in the back of my mind, I knew that I shouldn't have relapsed and that it just wasn't fun.
How do you consciously set your days so that those ideas won't come back to you of using?
Yeah, so for me, a spiritual part of my program is extremely huge. In the 13 years that I've stayed sober, I've never missed a day of prayer on my knees in the morning and on my knees at night. And I've done that every day for 13 years. And that connection that I have is what honestly keeps me sober. And I look at it as just a prayer of gratitude, because I knew where I was, you know, on February 17th of 13 years ago, and it was dark.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow. That's, it's amazing that you can get to that point, and that there has to be, not a struggle, but a surrender.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It's, as they say, surrender to win, which, for a guy like me, that
for NHL hockey players, that's not your slogan.
for a guy like me that was a fighter, I fought my whole life. Telling me to surrender was a hard concept, but it's true. You literally have to surrender to win.
Yeah. We're going to go to a quick break, and when we come back, well, let's explore why these things came to be.